Wapping project is a vision which encapsulates new work, the commissioning of writers, poets, choreographers, composers, filmmakers, video makers and photographers.
Hello and welcome to Pass Forward, the Wapping Project at 20, the Wapping Project's podcast series exploring the full range of arts that the Wapping Project have been involved with as a space, as a commissioning agency, and now as a dynamic international force across arts and culture. My name is Gareth Evans. I'm delighted to be your host of this edition and also of the whole series, and particularly excited in this particular instalment to be in conversation with the cinematographer and editor Tina Gallis and the artist filmmaker Andrea Luca Zimmerman about their remarkable feature-length essay film, Erase and Forget. Welcome, Andrea and Tina. It's great you can be with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Hello.
Very, very good that we can be in conversation about this really extraordinary film that you both made together over many, many years. Now, for listeners who have not yet experienced Erase and Forget, I wonder, Andrea, if you could just briefly set the scene as to its rather distinctive content.
Erase and Forget is based on James Boggrites, who is the highest decorated U.S. soldier in the history of the U.S., and the Rambo films were based on his life, in part based on his life, was also Francis Ford Coppola's Colonel Kurtz. William Shatner and Clint Eastwood funded some of his covert military operations, and he became infamous in US history until he became a whistleblower, and then he became infamous kind of extremist circles because he turned against his own government. And I worked with him over 10 years in order to explore how, if you've been involved in such propaganda-making, myth-making, deadly violence, perpetuation of deadly violence, because he also wrote the Special Forces Manual Latin America, for example. He was deeply involved in counterinsurgency, psyops, worked at the School of the Americas. And I became interested in, when the circumstances change and the political climate change, who is left with the dead on their consciousness? And so together we explored both the myth that made him, his self-creation as myth, mythical figure, but really the military-industrial complex and the deep cost on human lives.
Everything is in triple-fast motion. It goes so fast. It seems like you'd think those emotions would last for 5-10 minutes all night, a year. They only last an instant, because in combat, a heartbeat can be a lifetime.
Thank you very much. Well, there's a lot in there to digest and to unpack. And for listeners who haven't seen the film, of course, it will sound like a very potentially intimidating kind of ensemble of elements. But as you say, you're processing the life of James Boggrites, who is still with us. He is still alive, an elderly man now, who was at the heart of the kind of military cultural nexus of late 20th century American and international life. And you draw on a whole range, as you've suggested, of materials, home movies, found footage, Hollywood films we'll come on to shortly, that have portrayed him or run with him as an inspiring character, to create this multifaceted portrait of an incredible figure who in a way distills the chaos and paranoia and anarchy of American public and private life into a single portrait. Now, Tina, you both shot parts of the film and also edited it, and you were presented, as I've said, with this extraordinary range of materials, all of very differing technical qualities as well as very differing tonal makeup, shall we say. I wonder what your first thought was, before we come on to actually the idea of filming with Bo, about how you might gather this material into a coherent sequence.
Bo Grapes has taken many identities and he has many faces, and there have been many edits of the film and material collected, and many faces appeared in the edit, and a way through was to start to play with his identity and to try to seduce the viewer with his myth, and then undermine it and question it and put together. The edit is a collage, and it, through the connection between sometimes disparate elements, or a difference between image and word, there's a kind of constant warfare in the edit to encourage you to be active in the way that you look at it.
I want to just add to this because it's really important that, because we were also looking at what is the moral high ground, right? Like, it's very easy, I think, for people to say and to judge and say, okay, I would never do this. This guy is crazy. Oh, look, he's just like this. Or they behave irrationally or whatever. And we see the devastating effect of what this can lead to in today's climate. And we can't discard human beings because they're also part of a system that has been ejected from the mainstream discourse or from the kind of discourse of power. So we wanted to also emotionally play with the viewer. We wanted to make this person likable, and then also we made the viewer feel their own responsibility towards this history, because so long as you pay taxes and you don't make a stance, you're part of the perpetuation of such a system. And I think, like, we have to be anti-racist also. You have to make a stance as to where do you see yourself being, and that can't be fixed easily, right? It's too simplistic to take a moral high ground. So we have to actually engage with these differences to find a way forward together. That was really crucial for us. So it's an unusual emotional approach, and we did that on purpose because it's a political act almost for us. It was in order to challenge these ready binaries and kind of superiorities of otherings.
And I don't want anybody to think that these are just war stories I would tell in a bar or something. I really haven't told anybody. These are not easy. I'm not even sure they're good. I'm doing this because Andrea has asked me to, and I'm going to trust in her judgment.
So this is one of the very first films that is using the whole gamut of the online archive, because it was just at the brink of when it was possible to have longer films on YouTube. And even though most of the research and a lot of the film clips that were sourced prior to YouTube even being able to hold these clips, the kind of fan base of Greitz just coincided with our about to finish the film. So the last year we then had access to material that we even didn't have that we couldn't source before. So we just wanted to make a refraction, almost like a fractal, of these different impressions of this one character that is purely myth. He himself has based himself, or he became a hero through the kind of idealization of the American mythic hero. The soldier, the way in which they are filmed, portrayed within mainstream media and Hollywood cinema in particular. So there's this kind of fractal nature of that. And that was when you said before, Gareth, like how the film had a lot of positive responses, but also some critical ones. The critics were not yet ready. Not all critics were yet ready for such a film. Whereas now it's kind of commonplace that people do that.
The use of the footage is a dance with power, different kinds of power. By using different mediums, it's a way to engage with the different types of power that exist within image, in populist image, and like kitsch image.
We were bulletproof, and I kind of mean that.
Thank you both. That's really important, I think, to stress this idea of a multiple life, if you like, multiple lives within the life of this single character, Bo Greitz. And you've both very, very clearly drawn out both the political and the aesthetic strategies in kind of capturing that multiple identity. This is a man, after all, who had many passports and many aliases.
I am James Gordon Greitz. I am James Bo Greitz. I've been known as Swamp Fox. I've been called James Bond as the intelligence officer of Delta Force, and China Boy when we were working in Asia. I am who I say I am. God knows.
But Tyner, you first met Bogreitz, of course, filming with him. And this is a character, as Andrea has just described, who is far from your regular Joe, shall we say, in American parlance. This is someone who claims to have killed directly up to 400 people. So when you were trying to kind of, you know, challenge these binaries, as Andrea said, you are still presented in the flesh with a person who has exercised extreme violence on many, many people and many, many innocent people. What was your sense of your first meeting with Bo?
I met Bo, I think it was outside a motel in Tulsa before we were shooting in a gun show. And it was dark and I was in a car with him. And I realized that I would be with him for the next 4 weeks. And in filming, you have to work with, you have to establish a trust to be able to film. And I didn't know how it would be. And I distinctly remember I directly looked at Bo and he looked at me and I smelt him. So I was very instinctive. I realized that this would to be our beginning. And after that, our relationship was established. And he's surprisingly open, self-reflective. He's certainly courageous. So that was the beginning. But yeah, it was evocative.
No, it's incredibly evocative. I mean, I think we should all increasingly use the full sensory apparatus when we make those first meetings with people and see whether it smells good, quite literally. I think that's very striking. Thank you very much indeed, of course.
If life were like a video and you could just stop it in there in one frame, which I think you can, and you stop my life and that period, I would stand judgment for that.
Now, Andrea, of course, you had met Bo earlier and had decided to go on this remarkable journey with him. Now, you have said already that, you know, this is someone who challenges, you know, binary positions, and Tyner's already underlined that in her first encounter with him. But, you know, clearly this is someone you could only work with because he has come to a point of reflection, as Tyner suggested, about his previous life. Now, you've been on a journey over many years with him. Was that always a given, that he would retain that reflective quality and question his previous actions?
I mean, I think this is a really difficult question, almost, because every time I went to visit him, I had to reestablish that relationship. And even though we continued to be in touch when I wasn't there, I think after a few years, he thought this film is not going to happen. So he just, in a way, I think he just enjoyed the difficult conversations because he was at an age now where he wanted to talk and he wanted to speak and he wanted to think through the past he was part of making. And I think, I mean, the way in which I approached him originally was, I feel that somebody like him has an obligation to talk. He has an obligation to share what he was part of, precisely because, you know, we funded him, our structures made him, he was produced through these structures. So in a way, it's publicly funded history. So he has an obligation, I feel like, to speak. And the courage to do that, regardless of whether he was supposed to or not, I really value, because I think that's the right thing to do. And he was of an age where he, I think, wanted to do such. And I remember distinctly asking him, what would you do if you were to die and you were to see all the people you have murdered or who you have killed in conflict or whatever? And he said, I can't yet die because I have nothing yet to say to them. And I think that's a very, very profound reflection from somebody who doesn't feel, he struggles from PTSD, and he talked a lot about how he feels like a desert inside of him. And he can't feel love, he can't feel joy. He feels almost insane in a barrenness. And yet to try and grapple with the responsibility of one's action when one thought and was produced and was encouraged to be the best at these kind of executions and to teach others to do the same, in the name of patriotism, I think that takes a lot of courage, because most people, we don't have to face a profound rupture of our whole identity, right? We can sit back and survive without being tested in that way. And to be able to recompose oneself so absolutely, I think it's almost impossible, and sometimes need the extreme in order to understand how does this happen? How do we make these young people believe that this is the right thing to do? And we can see it. We can see it because, you know, not only is the arms trade one of the biggest earners for both the US and the UK, but also the kind of whole military apparatus is massive, and violence is exported nonstop. So it didn't start with him and it didn't stop with him. But we do not discuss it. And so I really valued that courage. And I think I just met him at the right time and I asked the right questions, because it's always about the questions you're asking somebody. So there's an offer of exploration together. And then I just want to say one more thing, which is that as a filmmaker too, early on, because he was surrounded by so many guns, one of the people who I was also filming with committed suicide with one of his guns while we were in the room next door. And it changed something in me, in my relationship to him, because it became almost a demand. Now you really have to speak. And I think the relationship became more serious after that event, even because the devastation of how quickly a life can just go, I would not normally have had to witness, right? And that was quite a big thing. I think the tragedy of that, the instrument that led to that, if the instrument wouldn't have been there, it wouldn't have happened. So it became a much bigger project very early on that was going away from him, but also into this kind of space of obligation, historical obligation, and also cultural obligation.
So now Jaime takes a bullet, puts it in, and shoots himself. So there's an instrument there that belongs to me, but I don't feel guilty. You know, I got over that. I might have if I'd have been a civilian, but in fairly good estimate, I've killed about 400 people. People don't know. Special forces are secret forces. You never see an actual story. There are no reporters with us.
No, thank you. Well, that's an extremely fascinating, compelling response to his life and character. And Tyner, I mean, Andrea mentioned the suicide early on in the film, and that takes place in the community of Sandy Valley, where James Boagwright's still lives, a desert location, one far from, you know, the urban centres of the US, and one that informs very much how we grow to perceive him over the course of the film, because we understand much more about a certain kind of American citizen from how we see them portrayed in the film, and also how he relates to them. That actually gives us a much more complex and nuanced view of the kind of recent Trump years than most news broadcasts would, for sure.
American government officials have no idea what Special Forces really does. They just know it's kind of like the easy button that you see advertised on television. You hit the easy button, somebody takes care of it, and good.
But when you were editing this Life Together Again, just to go back to this great challenge that you faced at the beginning with so much material in so many different registers, what did you find was your thread through? I mean, you've explained very clearly and compellingly about how you were constantly challenging, you know, a fixed identity between image and word and between the various forms you had. But what was your sense of the kind of the core drive, the core engine of the film in editing terms that would allow you then to build this much more complex portrait?
It went through stages, but initially I found that Bo was the anchor. I wanted to explore structuring it around his life roughly chronologically to play with his voice or his narration, because that paralleled Rambo and our desire for Rambo and the hero. So this was a very simple way in. the way that that's constructed partly by what you're told, what you, the reputation coming before him. But then as the edit progressed, I looked more and more in deeper and deeper into Andrea's work before that I had known about the film, and found such creative opening ways of documents of his life and of American political structures, actually, and increasingly looked to put that into the film as well. And what at one point Andrea let me read her thesis that I think she had written in 2006, the spectral and spectacular performance of political violence. And then I from that moment I felt very free to consider material also from the public domain, from YouTube, and because that was part of this dialogue. Yeah, those were the main steps. And then within we were kind of playing with the different media to so that it would allow more questioning, and also to be more exciting to encourage an emotional and cerebral response.
Tremendous. Thank you very much. I mean, it's very clear from what Tyne has said, Andrea, that, you know, what starts as a portrait, of a single person, of course, you know, rapidly ripples out to become, as we've said in different ways already, the portrait of a culture, a civilization, even in crisis. Now, you also both go to Bogart as women. And we are aware, as the film develops, of multiple marriages that he has and so on, most of which, of course, struggle to last too long. And I wonder if there is a gender relation in this film that allowed the film to happen in a way that might not have been the case if a male director had approached Bo. Is gender an issue in this for you?
Can I just explain to the listener that I'm... I don't really identify fully as a woman, and I have a shaved head, so I look quite androgynous. And I think there's also like I already look unconventional, I would say, so not like a pretty woman or something. So I think that gender relations will always be part of everything. I think we do, whatever the configurations are, is an appearance, right? How we encounter each other and the kind of histories we are both inhabiting, but also mirroring. So I think that's a given. And the negotiation, however, though, is I'm very, very honest with the people I work with, because I feel like the inquiry has to go beyond me and that person. So the inquiry has to become like what Tyne said, like there has to be a trust that starts to exist between us, but that trust doesn't mean that I trust what he says. So my role as a filmmaker is to probe and to try and find an entry that goes deeper, and to find information that is embodied. Like, for example, when he is talking about war crimes for the first time, that was made, you know, it's like a director, you have to create a circumstances by which something can be allowed to happen, and something can be allowed to be spoken in a way that we didn't expect. That's when the kind of gap between what one wants to know because one already knows and that which one doesn't yet know emerges. And I think that's where the real work can start.
We had black propaganda where we would use our soldiers dressed up to be LaGuardia Nacional, driving trucks that were marked with LaGuardia Nacional that ran over innocent people, so that the people would rise up in hatred for their own military. It was a separate unit that had a mission of unconventional warfare in Latin America. And if you ask the SINC, the commander-in-chief of Southcom, what that meant, he didn't know. And so it meant that it was left to me to determine what is unconventional warfare. I liked it that way.
So I think, yes, there might be gender relations, but also there was never an ambiguity. I think he thought I was a queer woman. Like, I was curious to him, I think, initially. But then also because, remember, he was Special Forces, right? So Special Forces, they're chameleons, especially of that generation still. So they used female assassins, he did, mostly and foremostly. So I think he had a fascination also with using people for his own purpose as he could. And I was very aware of that. And so the moments where we distrusted in a trustful way, I would say, is when I thought that he was perhaps trying to make me be on his side. But I actually don't think that was the case, to be honest, so often, right? This is just my natural suspicion as a filmmaker often. I'm very, very careful, and I'm very emotionally alert, let's say, at these kind of binds that might happen. And I always try and find embodied ways of undoing that stuff. So there was a lot of reenactment we did of standard routine operations or fiction scenes of the fiction movies he was part of, that kind of stuff, in order to avoid being drawn into a conversation that would lead to no new discoveries.
No, absolutely. Thank you very much. And I think it's important, obviously, as to kind of complicate the gender issue as you did there. Now this film was finished after many years, and you both took it to the prestigious Berlin Film Festival, where it premiered in competition in the documentary strand, and received, you know, very, very strong and positive audience responses, as well as critical responses. But perhaps most importantly for our conversation here, Beau, of course, himself, James Beau Greitz, saw the film. And I wonder if you could share with us how he found it when he saw himself, you know, and his entire life, really, or many aspects of it, represented to him, shall we say.
I think it's really difficult to see oneself on screen through the eyes of others, right? Because it's almost impossible, I think. So, but it's an ethical thing I have, where I always show films back to people who are in it. And so I went there just before Berlin, and it was interesting because I tried to make it as safe as possible, because he's, after all, also struggling with PTSD, and I know the triggers that can happen, and the film is not an easy film for anybody to watch, and very much so will be the same for him, if not even more so, because in the end there's nothing left. The film ends quite devastatingly.
You take something that could be a credit to mankind if they were given a chance, and you turn them into garbage. It was the devil that rode the waters. Then it was George Bush, Daddy Bush, that sent me to Burma, where I learned ultimately the reason that we weren't bringing prisoners home is what Pogo said, the cartoon character. We have met the enemy, he is us.
The footage in Burma, which we sourced from Patrick King and Tudor Gates, which was also then handed over to Margaret Thatcher, nothing ever happened to it. It was the evidence footage of US drug money that was funding US covert operations. And I never really quite believed that footage fully, because it was so stylized, or so hyper-stylized. But that was the moment when he had a PTSD flashback. I could just see there was increased tension in him, and he pulled out a gun off his couch, and I stopped the film, and all sorts of things went through my mind. It was like, oh my God. I wasn't scared for myself, but I was like, what is going on? And his pupils were massive, so I was like, he has a PTSD flashback. So I had to talk him out of it, or through it. And it was a very, very, very scary moment, because as a filmmaker, you obviously have a responsibility. I tried to have, you know, to ensure that there was a relatively safe environment. And I did not expect this flashback to happen, obviously, at that moment, which is what never, you just don't know what is the trigger point for certain things. And it was really, really extreme. I think his whole, I could see the level of despair that he was still experiencing, of his whole belief system collapsing at that moment, and this whole struggle towards survival, I guess, towards sanity after that has happened.
Erased all the fantasy that I had about the USA, the red, white, and blue, the leaders of humanity. It was all horseshit. In the soul, we were rotten, distributing heroin to our own people. This is decidedly wrong. So it meant that I was on the other side.
And just to close off and went through that letter, a very, very profound interview, which we then cut into the film. And I think just lastly to say is that if we don't engage with the reasons why people enter these spaces in the first place, we'll never move over towards a more peaceful environment. Because these deep betrayals, they pop up in all sorts of different aspects of our society, right? And the violence just keeps perpetuating. And so this was a profound moment for me also as a filmmaker to see that the pulse of this film was at a moment that was really truthful.
I wanted to be like my dad, who flew 8 hours on D-Day, which made England safe. I wanted to be a soldier, and I would have paid the government. They didn't need to pay me.
Thank you very much. I mean, I think for listeners who haven't seen the film, you will realize now, of course, that there is a huge amount of material in here. Some names have been mentioned, of course, that would become clear on a viewing as to their significance. But it goes without saying, of course, that we urge you to see the film. You can find the film, details of its streaming options at erasandforget.com. And so I do hope you will go there inspired by this conversation, but we're not over yet. So Tina, now thinking about this, you know, challenging and intense experience that you and Andrea went through together, and with your work as an editor and a cinematographer, I wonder if the process of making Erase and Forget changed or qualified or redirected your own work elsewhere, either as a director of photography or as an editor. Was there a kind of experiential shift that came out of this long process of making Erase and Forget?
Well, it certainly affected my understanding of the world from the shoot and then through the edit. In the edit, certainly that it made me feel stronger in playing with possibilities. It's hard to say, but certainly meeting Andrea and Bo had a significant effect on my thinking of questions of agency and responsibility.
Thank you. I mean, I think in terms of your own onward work, of course, recently you've completed, very closely involved in similar ways, a film called Lynn and Lucy, directed by Faisal Bulifa, which you were very deeply involved in on both those the fronts that we've talked about in relation to Erase and Forget. Now, a very different film, of course, a film focused on a female relationship, two women with a very intense and interwoven narrative. Now, that's one that, of course, was filmed, you know, exclusively in the UK, but carries on your great skill in cinematographically catching the intensity of experience and expression on screen. I'm not trying to force a kind of comparison between the two films, and of course you work widely elsewhere as well. But are you informed and drawn to these characters who are often marginalised by other forms of representation? I think Bo clearly is, despite his you know, centrality to the culture, he's fully marginalised now by the mainstream of American society. And of course, Lynn and Lucy represent figures, whole communities that are ignored and overlooked by the political and cultural mainstream. Is there a link there?
I didn't think of it in that way, but I'm attracted to this crazy, but to ideas of truth and ideas of and questioning. So I don't necessarily see those labels up front, but I do increasingly have appreciation of them, and of course I have prejudices as well that I'm thinking about. But I don't initially come from the view of difference, but I am interested in how people live and how they can be creative. And I never realized it, but I guess I'm probably naturally rebellious, and I don't know, but it's not conscious like that. But I'm interested in people who are more questioning, and directors who are provocative.
Tremendous. Well, that's a great way to think about, of course, Andrea Luca Zimmermann, but also about the kind of work the Wapping Project wants to support. And it goes without saying that the reason we're talking about Erase and Forget with Andrea and Tynes today is because the Wapping Project significantly supported the production of Erase and Forget. So if we could close with you, Andrea, this is a project obviously established by the late, great Jules Wright and now taken forward in co-direction by Marta Michalowska and Thomas Dannon-Larcher. And I know you're extremely grateful for the support the Wapping Project gave you for Erase and Forget, but how do you think about the lineage of that organisation's productions? Because you join a great lineage of work, and you join also a lineage of work where women's work, women's making is prioritised. So I imagine it was an important vote of confidence for you.
I mean, first of all, I am so grateful for this funding for many, many reasons. So one is that I remember going to the Wapping Project and seeing an amazing speaker, and it turned out that she had been adopted and she was working class, and I remember crying. And then Jules coming up and saying, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Oh no, but people don't publicly speak about my life experience." And then Jules herself spoke about her life experience. And I realized, you know, we are not alone. There are these maverick people, and Jules was such a maverick. She was an amazing person with a real vision, and she just made it, and nobody could tell her not to, and she just found a way. And she chose these collaborators like Marta and Thomas and Josh, who was her partner, but all the people she chose to work with in her own way. And I think she's one of those people who brought out the people's strength, and that is very special. So not to do things as they expect it to be, or how mainstream narrative or mainstream unfolding expects you to behave in order to get somewhere. Do you get a treat or something? But instead to trust people's capacity for extraordinary things if you provide the conditions for them to thrive, right? And so it was like a really special lineage to be part of that. And then also with Marta, I just remember going on a train journey with Marta. We did a talk as part of Film London, and I told her about Erase and Forget and how I've been working on this for so long, and like I need to finish it and it's almost done, but you know, and I talked about the whole kind of hopes and ambitions, but also doubts, because I didn't want to sell out with this project. That was really important to me. This is a very sexy project. Like, a lot of people wanted to have this project at certain stages in its iteration, but they wanted to make him the fall guy, right? They wanted to ridicule. They wanted to make a slapstick kind of out of it. And I wasn't interested in that. And so with the strength of and the vision of my collaborators, like Tynes, like, this is why I love Tynes so much. I think I can do anything with Tynes, right? Like, I can do any project with her, because of the way in which we think outside of the box. And there are a few other collaborators, like Therese Henningsen, for example, who are similar. And so we can steal horses together. I feel like we are hustlers in a lot of ways, right? And so we are drawn to these histories of hustlers, from whom everything is a bonus when you've experienced, I guess, hardship of some kind. And so I want to really thank them, because I remember then Marta saying, "Oh, would you like to apply for some funding?" And that's never happened to me prior to this. And so I embraced it fully, and they were so supportive, the Wapping Project. And it's incredible to have this kind of support. And yeah, so I want to thank you, you know, amazing work they have done ever since and before, and hopefully continue forever.
Well, tremendous. That's a great endorsement, of course, and entirely a perfect meeting, it seems, between yourselves, Andrea and Tynes, and of course Marta and Thomas and the Wapping Project, under the inspired origination and presiding spirit of Jules Wright. It's been a real pleasure to be in conversation with you both. Just to remind listeners, of course, that you can find the film details of streaming and so on, the full story behind the extraordinary life of Bogue Wright at eraseandforget.com. Please also, of course, contextualise that within the Wapping Project's own remarkable onward history at thewappingproject.org. Of course, this is part of the Wapping Project podcast series celebrating the Wapping Project at 20. Just one, of course, one small proviso. Andrea says that she and Tina and Therese even will be stealing horses together. The Wapping Project does not necessarily endorse the stealing of horses, of course, unless they are in a traumatic state and need to be rescued from brutal owners, in which case, steal away and may the stealing go with you wherever you are. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and many thanks indeed, of course, to both of you, Andrea Lucas-Inman and Tina Gallis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The lullaby is nice. I see my son. When I went to Vietnam, 64, my first son was born 1958. I was at Fort Bragg. My second son born 1960. And I remember doing this.
My watch says
it's 8:30.
It's 8:30.
He's gonna leave his little boy.
And an hour I must go. When I'll be back. Well, I don't know.
No kidding. Took me four years to come home.
Thank you very much indeed for listening. In the next edition of Pass Forward, the Wapping Project at 20, I will be in conversation with Shona Illingworth and barrister and human rights lawyer Nick Greith about their shared project, the hugely ambitious and important Topologies of Air, commissioned by the Wapping Project. I do hope you can join us then. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and goodbye.